So welcome, everyone. Love hearing you sign in from across the country. I'm Kathy Stewart, and this is the Politics for the People Book Club. Let me extend a special hello to our first-time book club participants. Tonight, we're going to explore The Secrets of Mary Bowser with author Lois Levine. Let me share with everyone how the call will work this evening. I'm going to introduce our guest. I'll ask the first couple of questions. Then we're going to open up for your questions. And our call tonight will run until 8 p.m. Our author and guest this evening is Lois Levine. Lois is an award-winning author of two novels, The Secrets of Mary Bowser and Juliet's Nurse. Lois says that she dwells in the spaces where literature and history meet. She has degrees in history and literature from Harvard, USC, and UCLA, and has taught at UCLA and Reed College. In addition to being a novelist, Lois is a frequent essayist and contributor to the New York Times, LA Review of Books, Huffington Post, and many other publications, literary and scholarly journals. Tonight, we're going to be talking together about The Secrets of Mary Bowser. Lois, let me just say, as I have said to you before, I love your book. We've all been enriched by meeting Mary Bowser, a slave from Richmond, Virginia, freed by Bet Van Leeuw, who lived and gained an education in Philadelphia, returned to Richmond caring for her father who was still enslaved, and became a Union spy inside the Confederate White House. So welcome to Politics for the People, Lois.
Thank you. Am I muted or unmuted?
You are unmuted.
Oh, excellent. I'm really excited to have this conversation. So, and I know we are limited to our hour, so I won't say much to preface it because I'd rather respond to your questions and the questions of everybody on the call.
Terrific, terrific. You know, as I was walking to my office today, Lois, I walked down Library Way in front of the New York Public Library, and a plaque that's embedded in the sidewalk caught my eye. It had a quote from William Styron that says, quote, "A great book should leave you with many experiences and, slightly exhausted at the end, you should live several lives while reading it," close quote. The Secrets of Mary Bowser definitely did that. Your novel is so rich. It's a layered book. We become intimates of Mary Bowser, privy to her thoughts, her development as a freed woman, a daughter, a wife, a spy. We meet so many people and learn so much about this period in American history and the Civil War. So let me kick off our conversation tonight by asking you how you met Mary Bowser and how you decided to write a novel about her life.
Sure. You know, when I was in graduate school, I was working a lot on African-American literature, and particularly intersections of race and gender in American literature and culture. I was doing my PhD at the end of the 20th century, and there was a book that was fairly recently published at that time called A Shining Thread of Hope by the historian Darlene Clark Hines. And this book was one of the first books to really just try and cover the topic of African-American women's history. It's a book of, you know, probably over 300 pages, and in there were three or four paragraphs about Mary Bowser. And it really captivated all of my interest, because in many ways, the story of Mary and her relationship to Bet was a lot of what I was reading and thinking and teaching about as an academic, in terms of what the relationship was between black and white anti-slavery activists, about what was going on, not just in the South, but in free black communities in the North. And I thought this would be a wonderful way to share the kind of academic research that I felt lucky enough to have the time and resources to do as a graduate student with an audience that was never going to read an academic book or article, was not going to walk back into a classroom ever again, but would be really fascinated and moved by this history. And so I thought, well, one day I'm going to write a novel about this. And if I had known how long it would take to write a novel, I'm not sure I would have started.
Because how long did it take?
You know, I always say there are certain questions a lady doesn't answer, but
okay.
It was certainly well more than a decade later before the book was published. And, you know, I have many degrees in literature, but I had not really ever thought of myself as a creative writer. But I wanted to get to tell this story, and I felt really committed to telling it in the first person voice, because I felt like I wanted people, myself included, to have to think about what it would be like to see slavery and freedom, North and South, you know, war and politics and peace and culture, all through the eyes of this particular individual. And so it was really a commitment to giving voice to her that brought me into the world of trying to figure out what it takes to write a novel.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the most intriguing relationships in the book, obviously, as you're saying to us, is the one between Bette Van Leeuw and Mary. And I wanted to ask you to say a little bit about it. You know, Bette frees Mary. They work intimately together. They're risking their lives as spies. And yet the relationship is not one of equals. Bette's a woman of enormous privilege. And there's this one point in the book where Mary says, you know, that Bette is not exactly family, not quite friend. Still, there was a bond between us unlike any I had with anyone else. And that really stayed with me throughout the book. And I wanted to ask you to talk about their relationship some and the ways in which they also both used society's views of them as women and for Mary as a slave to their advantage.
Sure. And I'll talk a little bit first about the historical part of that and then the world that I created in the novel, because one of the truths is simply that although as a white woman that couldn't vote, she was very restricted in what she could do, she was by race and by class, because her family was wealthy, very privileged. And so there's a lovely biography by a historian, a professor of history at the University of Virginia, Elizabeth Varon, about Bette Van Leeuw, because Bette's life could be so well documented. And as I think your blog discussed, I wrote a piece about a picture that has circulated for years purportedly of Mary Bowser that it isn't even of the right person.
Right.
And that's a huge difference in what we can learn about these two women, that even though certainly gender and the limitations of gender impacted both of them, the impact is really different, that it's much harder to learn about the daily lives of African Americans, even free blacks, because they would be much less likely to have, you know, property that was left in wills or deeds to things that they owned. So some of it is, for a historian, a really different challenge to try and work around the life of somebody whose life was just much less likely to be documented. But I was also interested in thinking deeply about this relationship. I neither wanted to make Bette a perfect character nor a completely flawed character. And the same is true for Mary. And I think that in many ways, each of them has to unlearn assumptions that they have about the other one over the course of the novel, and that is part of the emotional arc for each of these characters. And I think that that's true even today in our lives, that we can think about, you know, whether it's an interracial alliance or some other crossing alliance where we're trying to act together around a cause that is important to us, but we still, although our impulse might be right, we might have assumptions that we need to unlearn as we go, and we might need to learn as much about ourselves as we have to learn about somebody who we can see is different from us in some other way. And I think that whatever race somebody is today, it's easy to look back on something that we now acknowledge is as terrible as we now acknowledge slavery was, and imagine that we would have done the right thing in that setting. And I think that we're being perhaps a little overly simplistic in our understanding of that. Mm-hmm. And so trying to really get at how difficult it can be in any historical moment to do the thing that is most respectful and most just, and really wanting to show that is difficult. You know, I have a Bette who doesn't hesitate to believe that an education is the most important thing Mary can have, but also doesn't really understand what it means to have to give up their daughter for Mary's parents or to give up her parents for Mary. And that,
right.
that you know, you can read that even in, when we think about debates, for example, for kids who are first generation to go to college, right? We think this is a wonderful opportunity, but it, we don't always acknowledge what it means for kids to have to travel both little geographic distances, but also sometimes the huge cultural leaps that people have to make to enter into something like post-secondary education in the United States. So I feel, again, like this is a lesson that that we can keep learning in our daily practice around social justice and social causes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you do such a rich service to that. And I think that the thing I also loved about the book and in Mary and Beth's relationship is the whole issue of what's racial equality. Well, there's emancipation and being freed, but that's only step one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that moment where Mary and Bette have this exchange where Bette is basically saying, well, it's simple. People will just, they'll just know that everybody's the same. So I think you do a very, very good job at conveying the complexities here. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, I think also for me as an author, I really struggled with this notion of exceptionalism. That is to say, I didn't want to make readers feel like Mary was so wonderful she deserved to be free. I wanted to make, and a librarian I know posted on Facebook after reading the book, he said, this is going to sound dumb, but I never really realized until I read this book that slavery was wrong just because it was wrong, that we don't have to talk about either how wonderful a particular individual is or how cruel a particular situation of slavery was. And I think we do know that historically, Bette Van Leeuw and her family thought that Mary was exceptional, that she, Mary was baptized and married in the white church where the Van Leeuw family worshipped, which was not the case even for other slaves or servants in the Van Leeuw household. So she was distinguished even from other blacks that they interacted with regularly. We know in Bette has a diary from the Civil War, which is exactly not the diary that you wish it was, because you want to hear all the nitty-gritty details of the spying. And her diary, as befits Bette, is full of grand political polemics, where she's just going on and on about principles, and you think, no, we want that, the details.
Right.
But the one of the few details that she gives is that she says, you know, I wake in the morning and I say, what news, Mary? And my caterer, which is a word that in that period really meant servant, my caterer never fails. By far the best information we get is from the Negroes. So even in this entire spying that she was involved with, in her diary, she calls out Mary by name, but not much detail beyond that. So while Bette related to Mary as exceptional, I wanted Mary to tell her own story in a way where mm-hmm. she kind of led readers to see that actually she wasn't exceptional in the sense of deserving her freedom, that slavery was wrong. Is, you know, there's a point where she's in the North, realizing that the depictions of slavery in the North are all the most brutal depictions. And she really struggles to say, how can I make people understand that even if you weren't being whipped regularly, slavery was wrong? And of course, I put those words in her mouth because I'm a manipulative author, and I really wanted my readers to think about those things.
Right, right. Well, here's a question. When in writing the book as a trained historian, obviously that gave you, that just opened up many doors for us as your readers. But what was your greatest challenge and what was the most exciting thing about writing about Mary?
Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, I think the challenge was always how little was really known. And when I started this book, I was like, despite my, you know, many years of education, I was like most people in the United States in terms of thinking about slavery really largely in terms of a plantation context. So I really had to learn about what life was like in Richmond, which was urban and industrialized, and where one out of every five blacks in the city was free, and where in terms of day-to-day, some enslaved blacks had far more liberty than they did, but they still weren't legally free. And even mm-hmm. if you could, you know, live in a house of your choosing, or you could negotiate where you would going to be working for the year. All the wages went to the person who owned you, and that person could buy and sell you or a member of your family at any time. So I think one challenge was just learning all of the history to get it right, and another was figuring out how to convey it in story in a way that let readers understand, again, that sort of what it would have been like truly to experience that. And it was, I mean, again, I was learning how to write as I was doing this. So sort of exciting for me when things would fall together without me even anticipating it. So sometimes I would read something in a history book about, you know, I'm reading history about Richmond in the 19th century, and there's some story about how one year a bunch of fish swim up one of the canals and die, and it happened one year and it didn't happen any other years, and it was just such a weird thing that all these fish did this thing and died. And that just, I wasn't looking for that piece of information. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but there's a point in the book where Mary is talking about having been inoculated against smallpox, and I remember that incident as a writer and use it to put in there something about why her mother decides to let her be vaccinated, even though in fact her mother had no choice in the matter, but her mother wants to feel like she has a choice in the matter. So like that was also sort of, it's both empowering and a little bit terrifying when you move from the world of writing non-fiction kind of scholarly articles to creative writing where things, you can't always plan for things to come together, or you're not laying out an argument in the same plotted way, and yet the pieces all come together and it just feels really wonderful and powerful.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. At the end of the book, I wept at this moment that's shared between President Lincoln and Mary Bowser as he visits the fallen Confederate White House and Mary's there. And I love Mary's brilliant statement in telling her president that she, quote, wasn't working for Jeff Davis. I worked for freedom and for you, Mr. Lincoln. And it made me wonder what we know, if anything, about Mary's life after the war.
Well, what we know departs a lot from the novel. So readers who want to cherish the novel are welcome to cover their ears, as I say, whatever that's to say. Because there are a few but not many traces. Immediately after the fall of Richmond, she began working in what were called freedmen schools, which were schools for formerly enslaved African Americans, and they were essentially run by the government. And so she worked in some freedmen schools immediately in Virginia. We know that in the fall of 1865, so about 5 months after the war ended, she went on a speaking tour in New York, because I was able to track down two instances of her giving talks, and she was using a pseudonym then, which makes sense because if you were a black woman living in the South who had spied for the Union during the Civil War, you might not
right.
want your identity known even after the war has ended. But as a historian, it's a little bit frustrating because it's much more difficult, and we don't know if she may have given other talks where they would have been documented, because we don't always have access to every 19th century newspaper that might, and that's how we know about these, that 19th century newspapers that might have covered her talks. And at that point, she is already really agitating for there to be more attention to what's going to happen to blacks now that slavery, where all the focus has been, is over. What does that mean in terms of equality and in terms of people's day-to-day safety? By 1867, she was living in Georgia, teaching at a freedman school, and Harriet Beecher Stowe happens to travel through the town where she's working, and they met, and we know a little bit about this event because Stowe and her brother and another, somebody who had been an abolitionist and at that point was working for the Freedmen's Bureau, meet Mary, and they all write about it. And we also have the only direct documents we have from Mary herself from any point in her life, the only direct documents that have ever been located are letters that she wrote to the head of Freedmen's Bureau for the state of Georgia, in which she's talking about teaching school. And she is keenly aware of how dangerous that position is. She says, you know, I have been an agent of the federal government, and I know that these white people here cannot be trusted, get a little liquor in them, who knows what will happen. And she's really anticipating the terror that the Klan and other racist acts are going to rain down for generations to come. And she teaches there for at least a good chunk of the first part of 1867. And then, and here's the part where readers may be very disappointed, Mary and Wilson Bowser's relationship, we know absolutely nothing about it except that they were married on a particular day at that church. So everything else about their relationship I have invented. And I know that by the end of the war, she was no longer using the name Bowser. And by June of 1867, she was married to somebody else. And that husband had left the area of Georgia and gone somewhere in the Caribbean. I knew he was making a trip to Cuba. And she basically says, I'm shutting down the school so I can go be with my husband. But we don't know whether that meant they were going to Cuba, whether they were going somewhere else in the Caribbean, whether that was just a trip before they settled some other place. So she really disappears from the historical record by 1867, and we have no idea what happens to her afterward.
Wow, that's fascinating. We're going to open up now to questions from our members, and we're going to kick off with questions from book club members that were sent in advance. And our first question tonight comes from Caroline Dinola. Caroline is the member of the book club that recommended we read The Secrets of Mary Bowser, so thank you for that, Caroline. In order for us to hear you, you have to press star 6 to unmute yourself. Caroline, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can. We know you're on a train. I can hear the train, but we can hear you. That's okay. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to meet you, Lois. And I love the book so much. And we learned so much history in this book, and even just the fact that Mary Bowser existed, which we did not know. And there's so much we could talk about and questions I could ask about the history of the period and the little known aspects. But the thing that I wanted to ask you about is how you created and built the characters of the book, but particularly Mary's character, with so little information about her, how you decided what she would sound like, how she would think, how she would respond to various challenges. What was your process for bringing her to life?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I thank you for the question and also for this whole conversation, for bringing the book to the group. I mean, in some ways, I through much of my time in graduate school was really reading and thinking about African-American experience, and so I had a lot of primary documents that I was working with. I could read journals and letters and articles that had been published, as well as these private writings of African-American women, some of whom had experienced slavery and some of whom had not. So I felt like this was a world that was not entirely new to me when I started writing about this character. It's also true that when you write about characters, you have to sort of love them and live them, whoever your characters are. And so in some ways, I would really try to imagine myself in some of these roles or thinking about. I have the example I used before of first-gen kids going off to college. I have a number of friends who are first-generation in their family to go to college, in some cases leaving the country where they grew up for the opportunity of being educated at, you know, an Ivy League school in the United States. And so even thinking, sort of pulling together both what you know from the historical documents and thinking about what feels more like broad human experience, but also very much wanting to make this a particular character, to have her have her own personality, and thinking about what that meant. You know, one of the hardest things to do, and this is about to be a spoiler, so those of you who haven't read the book yet, cover your ears. One of the hardest things that I had to do in terms of how much I love both Mary as a character and other characters in the book is to have her mother die. And we don't know anything about her parents. What the historical Mary told people about her parents is wildly contradictory. So I've made things up. But I also knew that her mother was such a wonderful and strong character that Mary sort of couldn't come into her own until her mother wasn't there. And so just thinking about the potential for character in that way and trying to make her, as well as other characters in the book, as real as possible. And, you know, I read everything when I'm working on a book. So I read cookbooks and medical guides from the time period just to understand what people ate, what they wore. I was one of those, and I'm sure I'm probably not the only person on the call about whom this is true. I was one of those kids who read Louisa May Alcott's Little Women over and over as a child. And mm-hmm. I went back to that book an awful lot when I was writing this book because it would remind me of things of like, what fabric would the wealthiest girl wear to the ball? And what fabric would the girl who's was from more constrained means wear to the ball? And a lot of the, when I was writing about the abolitionist fairs, there are charity fairs that are described in Little Women. So I was really looking everywhere I could for information. Even things like thinking about music, what are the hymns that Mary and her family would know? What would be the difference in the kind of services that she was used to in a small black prayer meeting, a surreptitious prayer meeting in Virginia versus the AME church? Mother Bethel in Philadelphia was a large, vibrant church, and how different it would be for her to go there. So to thinking about all of those things, there are books about, you know, what did the 19th century sound like, and really thinking about the difference in all the sensory experience that you would have in Richmond, Virginia versus Philadelphia, and trying to bring those things together. And of course, I did have to learn a little bit about Civil War battles, even though I was always one of those people who was incredibly bored and uninterested when we were studying the Civil War in school, because it felt like it was all about battles, but really thinking for Mary and for other characters about what it was like to live through so much and such intense, devastating violence, and also the disease, not just the violence of the war, but the disease that had such a huge impact, particularly in the South, and hunger as well. That's a very long-winded answer. I hope you feel that I've satisfied you, Caroline.
Great answer.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks for your question, Caroline. We're now going to go to Helen Abel, an activist from California. Helen, you have to press *6, and then we'll be able to hear you. Are you there, Helen?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Go right ahead.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Lois, so much for writing this book. One of the most astonishing parts of the book for me was how Mary Bowser extended the Civil War by withholding particular information so that slavery would become a main issue for Lincoln and not just preservation of the Union. Was this event found in your research of Mary Bowser's work? And were there other spies who impacted the Civil War in this way or in similar ways?
Well, we know absolutely nothing about what Mary actually, what the contents of her spying, and really not much about the contents of Bette Van Loo's spying otherwise. We know that after the war, Ulysses Grant said of Bette, she sent him the best intelligence he had from the Confederate capital, but no details. What I knew was that I wanted readers to understand that there's still a great debate in our country about whether the war was about slavery or not. And even for Northerners, had the war ended earlier, it would not have ended slavery. And just thinking about that, which is a sort of shocking realization, was something that I wanted to pull into the book. And the way, by choosing to have Mary make that, have it be something that Mary actively gets to say, you know, I'm going to hold back on this information, it also in some ways implicates her for all of the devastation that happens in the years to come. I mean, this is really, for me, the fundamental lesson about the Civil War is that the slavery, the cost of ending slavery in this country was a tremendous cost, and it was a tremendous cost for Southerners as well as Northerners, for whites as well as blacks, and sort of implicating Mary not just in the wonderful part we feel good about, which is the ending of slavery, but in the horror of how many people died was important for me to do. I think that there were many spies who helped the Union cause, including many African-American spies who helped the Union cause. And whether any one of them truly prolonged the war, any person truly prolonged the war, I think it would be really difficult to say in retrospect. But I think that there was definitely a great deal of tension in the first years of the war between those who wanted Lincoln to more adamantly declare that this was a war about slavery and to ensure that once the war ended, slavery would end, and those who just wanted a quick end to what was devastating. You know, the last state to enter the Union as a slave state was West Virginia, and West Virginia, I think, entered the Union in 1864 as a state. I may be off by a year, but that's during the Civil War. The Union was still welcoming in new states as slave states. And just thinking about that, again, complicates our notion of oh, the Union was good, the North was good, the South was bad, and right. really thinking about some more of those details.
Thanks, Helen. Great question.
Right,
and to me, yeah, to me, this is such a key aspect of what the book does in terms of bringing these great historic moments that are fraught with so much devastation and this question that still gets debated today about what the Civil War was about, when was it about, what was it about. To me, that one of the takeaways from the book is that that question was answered on the ground by real people, ordinary and extraordinary. And here I think another part of the book that draws this out is Mary's husband, who goes to war with fellow African Americans in the U.S. colored troops, and they see the putting on of that uniform, even knowing they were going to face far more devastating circumstances. There were no prisoners of war if you were African American, but they saw that as an act towards ending slavery. And just the contradictory nature of how history moves, I think that the book does a brilliant job of drawing us into that very sensuously.
And, you know, I think if we know anything about black troops in the Civil War, it might be from the movie Glory, which is about the Massachusetts 54th, which as a big Hollywood production, I think actually works very well. And it also takes care to give each of the African-American characters their own personality and their own story. But there were almost 200,000 black men who served in the United States Colored Troops. So the Massachusetts 54th was one piece of the way that black men joined the military
right.
as part of that struggle, but such a small piece. And there's a, you know, I describe the flag that the USCT 22nd marches under and what it was like to march into Richmond. And that flag really exists, and it was designed by David Bastille Bowser. And the original flag is lost because it was not kept. At some point, whatever military storehouse it was in, they were moving the contents, and they didn't bother to keep it. So this was, again, not considered important history. But
wow.
imagining if the image is of a black man with a bayonet holding a white, he's in a Union uniform holding a Confederate white soldier at bayonet point as that man is on the ground, obviously about to surrender. And I cannot imagine what it would have been like to see that flag as somebody who lived in Richmond, as Mary
yes.
describes in the very end of the book.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Our next question, we're going to go to Alice Rydell from Manhattan. Alice, just to remind you, you have to press *6, and that will unmute your phone, and then you can ask your question.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me?
We can, loud and clear.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, Lois. I was very moved by your book, and I feel like I'm learning a lot on this call as well. I was wondering, given the content of your book and what's happening today politically, do you consider yourself a social activist?
I certainly hope so, Alice. I mean, I think in some ways, in my day-to-day life, absolutely, you know, I try and act around many causes that are important to me. And I do wonder about what it means for people who teach or make art to make that a political practice, and really a practice moved towards social justice. But this book in particular, I feel really lucky to have been able to bring this book to readers. And I've heard so many positive things. I was once, there's a group called the Deltas, which is a sorority, a black sorority. And this is not a sorority in the sense that like people are doing parties when they are in college. It is really a black women's networking organization for women professionals once they're out of college. And I was presenting at a meeting of the Deltas here in Portland, Oregon at some point. And one of the women in the room, so this is, you know, black professional women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And one of the women in the room said, "How did you know how to write my story?" And it was a very striking question. Now, I'm asked all the time what it's like to be a white woman writing about black experience. But when she said my story, I thought, now this is really fascinating, because obviously this woman has not had to ride around in a carriage. She's never lived in a place where legal enslavement of other human beings was allowed. This is not her story, but what she meant was, you have given me something, you have recognized something that is so important and precious to me that it feels like it's about my own life, even though it's really just about a history that I attach to. And when the book first came out, there's in Richmond, Virginia, there's an activist who has a radio program there who is a black activist. And she said to me, like, what made you want to write a book about our history? And I said, well, I think it's important to think about this history as Richmond history and Virginia history and black history, but I think that this is also American history. And so in some ways that is also part of that activism. It's understanding our past, and it's understanding how that past informs our present and what we need to learn from that past so we can shape our present and our future. Absolutely.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that question, Alice. We're now going to open up. We're now going to take a further set of questions, and here's how this section is going to work, everybody. I'm going to press a button that moves us into the Q&A mode, and you're going to hear an announcement about that in a moment. Once we're in Q&A mode, to ask your question, you press star 6, then you'll hear a voice telling you to press 1, and you'll pop up in the queue. And then I'm going to call on people as you enter the queue. When you're asking your question, please say your name and your state. Okay, so we're going to hear the buttons being pushed now. Okay, everybody, so we're in Q&A. And while everybody's signing up, I see our first question comes from Dr. Jesse Fields, a physician in Harlem. Jesse, you can ask your question now. Jess, you're going to have to press star 6. Okay. Let me do this. We're going to go. Here we go. Jesse, there you are. Jesse,
okay.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I'm here. Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Jess. You can ask your question.
Thank you so much, Lois, for the book. As many have said, I really loved it as well. One of the things that I love about the novel is that it conveys, as you were just saying, a great deal of African-American history in a very intimate fashion. That history also being integral to American history. Some examples, the focus on black people living in Richmond, Virginia, and the centrality of Virginia in the founding of the country and in the Civil War, and in the black community portrayed in Philadelphia, where I'm from, and where the Constitutional Conventions and events key to the founding of the nation occurred. So your book really brings issues of history alive, and such issues of history, race, and racial division that are still very, very relevant today. It seems to me very important that literature can open up that history for people of color, black and white, for all of us, really. That's really valuable, but very rare for both races to do that, to discuss that history in dialogues together, something that you mentioned in one of your interviews that I read. I watched the interview of you by Bill Knauer, which Kathy put up on the Politics for the People website, mm-hmm. and you said you've studied and taught African-American literature, which you've spoken about tonight as well. And I was very intrigued and wanted to ask you, maybe you could say more about this, about how has your study of African-American literature influenced the writing of the novel? And also, what was your experience as a white woman creating the voice of Mary Bowser?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I was sort of hoping that as a Philadelphian, you would ask me to say something about the Philadelphia section of the novel, because I think it's as important that people understand that history too, that, and I'll just see this so other people can ask, that many of the characters that you meet in that section were real people. They were African-Americans who were part of a vibrant, politically active, but also artistically productive, people working across many professions in that time period. So I love to talk about that as well. But I will actually answer the question that you asked, which maybe is a little bit about, I could not have imagined this novel without having studied African-American literature so deeply, even things that are set much later. So there's a piece called The Ethics of Living Jim Crow by Richard Wright, in which he talks about growing up in the Jim Crow South, at a point where his mother was a domestic laborer, and there was no daycare she could put her child in, so he was left by himself all day while she worked. And at one point, another white kid in the neighborhood started throwing bricks at him, and he beat that kid up, and he was so excited to like have his mother come home to comfort him. And when she sees that he looks like he's been in a fight, and she asks what happened, and he wants a mother's comfort, and he tells her, she hits him. She is pretty brutal in her punishment. And when he's looking at that lesson years later, he doesn't want to say, I had a terrible mother. What he wants to say is, my mother had to teach a child how to survive in the violent racism of the Jim Crow South, and that I had to learn that I was never to raise my hand to a white, even a kid, even if we would think of this as a fight between children, because it could endanger my life. And trying to think through stories like that, one of the very first scenes in the novel, Mary's father spanks her for saying something, for identifying the Van Loo house as her house. And it is a heartbreaking scene for me to write, because it is exactly that. It's something that I was learned from authors like Richard Wright or James Baldwin, and certainly many African-American women writers, 19th and 20th century writers, about how difficult it is to negotiate protecting your family in a place where you legally really have very few or maybe no protections of them. So that, I couldn't have imagined this novel without the many wonderful writers who came before me. Mm-hmm. One of the, every so often, a reader, usually a white reader, will say, well, I don't understand how Mary could know all these big words. She was only a slave, which I find fascinating. Mary knows more words than I did. I had to look up many words to learn them, to put them in Mary's mouth. Mary was better educated than I was, because, of course, in Philadelphia, she had a private school education, whereas I like to say I just went to a public school in suburbia. But that perhaps one of the greatest American writers, and certainly one of our greatest orators, was Frederick Douglass, who never had a day of formal schooling in his life. He was entirely self-taught, and this book, I mean, he's referenced as a cultural force in the book. He doesn't appear as a character because the chances that Mary would have interacted with him in the trajectory I give her were almost non-existent. But he is a cultural force who is referenced in the novel, and just knowing all of that work. I think at the end of the book, I give Mary's reading list, which is really in some ways my reading list of how much I learned from all of that. Mm. Did I fully answer your question, Jesse?
Yes, I think yes, yes. Thank you very much. You can say more about Philadelphia. I mean, a grade school student, I did visit the Bethel Church, founded by Richard Allen, which you mentioned, yeah. You know, such a big thing of the book. So there is much more you can say about that perhaps further on. But yes, those writers are very meaningful and significant to me as well. And thank you so much, Lois.
Thanks, sure, thank Jesse, you. For that. Thank you. Yeah. Actually, let's go to Philadelphia. Jen Bullock, who is the coordinator of Independent Pennsylvania's, is in our queue. Jen, I think you're going to have to push star 6 so we can hear you. Jen, are you there? I see you, Jen. Can you hear me? Go ahead, Jen. We'll be able to hear you now.
Great. Okay, super. Well, I really, really enjoyed reading your book as a lifelong Philadelphian and activist here, and thinking about the Quaker fairs in Washington Square West, where we hold protests for opening primaries. And I wanted to ask you about your courage and politics, and how you so powerfully and unapologetically exposed the particular kind of insidious northern racism, particularly among the white progressives. I was so moved in the one part of your book where folks were asking Mary, you know, why, you know, what was slavery like and what were you treated like, going to your comment that, like, you know, it was portrayed as the most egregious parts of what happened in the South. So people were poking and prodding at Mary saying, what was it like? It must have been so horrible. And she responded by saying, well, it's confusing because in Richmond, the reason why we're treated so badly is because we're slaves, but what's the reason here in Philly?
Mm-hmm.
Which still takes my breath away. And, you know, partly I think because I was reading that at a time where the pantheon of progressivism, Starbucks, there was an incident,
right,
that went national where two black men just a couple months ago, not in 1850, got arrested for sitting in the Starbucks, which everyone talks about as this, you know, king of progressivism. So I wanted to ask you where you got what it was like to expose a particular kind of northern racism, and how you did that so beautifully in your book.
Yeah, I think that it is an easy thing for people who live in other regions of the country to think that racism is a southern issue or a regional issue. And I, many years ago, had the pleasure of being at a conference of scholars of African-American literature and history. And there was somebody there, his name is John Lowe, who is a white southerner. And he said, you know, the one thing that white and black southerners have in common is that you all hear us speak and you think that we're stupid. And the one difference that we have is that when you hear a white southerner speak, you always assume that we're racist. And it was a very valuable lesson for me about how much regional prejudice we bring to our lives. It is undoubtedly the case that life was better in Philadelphia for African Americans than it was in places where people were still enslaved well into the 19th century. But it is also true that there was slavery all through this country, and that the end of slavery was not the end of racism. I don't, you know, you use the word courageous to describe me. I never felt particularly like I needed to be courageous in writing this book. I will tell you that anytime I felt like giving up, I thought, well, I'm not doing anything near so difficult as what Mary or any of the African-American activists in that time period did. So I don't feel that I need to valorize the role that I took. But I think it is really important that we recognize, as you said, that racism shaped and continues to shape so much of what happens in America, in both in very large ways, so that, you know, we can elect a black man president, but yet have a significant number of Americans say, oh, he wasn't really born in this country, which is to say he could not legitimately be president of this country. So big ways that we still have that racism, and all of the small ways that even if you're not the person who's thrown out of the Starbucks or similar, that African-Americans are, and other people of color are, held suspect in daily interactions in this country. So I think that you're right to say that we have to make that connection between the history and the present day. And really, like everything else in the novel, it was a matter of just being historically accurate. I didn't make up the fact that schools were closed to African-American students, even in Philadelphia, which prided itself on being the Quaker city of brotherly love. I didn't make up the fact that blacks were not allowed to ride the streetcar, which, you know, imagine if we had racial exclusion on public transit, what that means. I didn't make up all of these incidents that I sort of give in the novel are the fact, which I was shocked to learn, that in Pennsylvania, African-American men, because again, at that point, women couldn't vote, but African-American men had the right to vote early in the 19th century, and then it was taken away from them. Like, so all I was doing was really sharing what I was learning as I was mm-hmm. learning it. But I think that you're right that it's more about what did it mean for Mary to speak up around other anti-slavery activists. And this was a big struggle that the abolitionists, not everybody who was anti-slavery would have described themselves as an abolitionist, and not everybody in that movement agreed. So in Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs, who are two of the best known writers of slave narratives, both of whose work anybody interested in this time period would do well to read, they both had the experience of stealing themselves to freedom, and then the question of whether somebody else should raise the funds to, once they were out and free in the North, raise the funds to buy them out so that they could not legally be sent back to slavery. And they disagreed on whether that was something that each of them wanted for themselves. And I think that that's really important to understand, that somebody might want, as Douglass did, to be absolutely assured of their freedom, that nothing could force them back into slavery. And somebody else might be disgusted, as Harriet Jacobs was, to think, I have already taken my freedom. What does it mean that you can still buy me and decide to free me? And be horrified at the notion that after having made a life for herself in freedom, she could still be bought and sold that way. And I don't think that one of them was more right or more wrong, but understanding the complexity of that history is really important.
Thanks, Jen, for your question. We're gonna get one or two more questions in here, and we're gonna go to Harry Kresge. Harry, all you have to do is talk.
Hello, Harry, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Great. Well, as others have said, I just love the book. Thank you. One of the Mary Bazis seemed like she knew what her mission was, and I think Mary Bett, Elizabeth Bett, Bett Van Loo. I don't know whether she, in freeing Mary Bazis, she knew or hoped that Mary would have such a sense of responsibility to other African Americans, to her family, and so on. This issue of what African Americans and others do with opportunity, giving back, so-called, is a complicated and controversial one. So I remember during the Clarence Thomas hearings, when he was nominated for the Supreme Court, many liberals attacked him for not being progressive and not being liberal. And he said, well, if the civil rights movement means anything, it means that I have the right to live the life that I choose to live. So the book and the discussion has been making me think about that issue. I'm not so much looking for your position on that. That's obvious. Well, it's not obvious, but what do you think about that? What do you think the book has to teach us about that and so on?
Yeah, I mean, this question of how people identify, when I watched Black Panther, the new film, I thought it actually engages with this question in an interesting way as well, which is the question of can the people of this mythical country of Wakanda, who seem to be able to live and thrive peacefully, do they have a responsibility to other blacks? In that case, I think it's construed more in terms of a global black identity, whether those black folks are in Africa or in the United States or anywhere. Like, what does it mean to have that success, and what responsibility do you have for others versus whether that is always replicating something where every achievement becomes not enough of an achievement, maybe? I mean, I think that that's a really interesting question that you're asking. I will avoid quoting Clarence Thomas, but I will say that when Thurgood Marshall announced that he was stepping down from the court, he was asked whether a black person should be appointed to replace him. And his response was, a black snake can bite you just as badly as a white snake can. So he understood that simply using race as a marker for any kind of political stance or any idea about rights was not actually going to necessarily be a guarantor that we would get a justice in replacing him who would truly replace him in terms of how decisions would be made on the court.
Great question. Thank you, Harry. We're going to try to take one more question. Julie Leek, I hope you have a quick one. And I think we'll be able to hear you. You can just talk. Julie,
yes.
Are you there? Go for it.
Yes,
yep,
I'm
we
here.
Can hear you.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Maybe this is a good one to end on. It seems somewhat trivial, but I want to thank you for the book. I learned an awful lot about history, but what you said about the Delta, who said that you had written her story, I was impressed and moved, and I remembered hanging clothes on the clothesline where you referenced that, and I can remember my mother hanging out clothes early before she'd go to work, and they would freeze on the clothesline, and sometimes now I would love to have a clothesline again. And my mother had 9 brothers, and my grandmother's house was out in the country, and they all had hogs. And so we had we would scrape the table after dinner, and it would go into the slop jar. So I might be the only one, maybe I'm one of the few people that had reminiscence of that. And the person that told you told her story just reminded me of those instances.
You know, I'm not sure there was quite a question in there, but I'll.
No, it wasn't a question. It's a reminiscence of my growing up in the South.
Well, you know, I was in Richmond when I first started writing this book. I went to Richmond to do some research, and after the book came back, I was invited to come back to Richmond, and I gave a whole bunch of talks that, one of which was recorded by C-SPAN, and I think Kathy may have posted it, that or could post it if folks are interested in it. But the giving talks all through Richmond as they were celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and Emancipation, which the leaders of some of the universities and museums there very carefully articulated it that way because they wanted to recognize the end of slavery as part of the 150th celebration. So this was probably 2013 when I was there. And the person who was driving me around all day, who just volunteered to do this, is an African-American woman who had grown up in Richmond. Her family had been there for many years. She could trace her family back to an enslaved person who she said they had reason to believe had also collected information to help the Union. And so she and I are talking about race and the history of race and racism in Richmond all day long. She's driving me from one place to another. And one of the places that I spoke was in the novel, you'll remember references to Lumpkin's Alley, which was both a slave jail but also a public whipping post. And I spoke at that very site in Richmond, and I read some of the scenes that were described there. And as she and I arrived there, she said, "It always upsets me to be here." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Just knowing it could have been my family bought and sold here." And that is also something that I respect. You know, my family may have been persecuted in some other place, but I don't have to walk or drive or live my life around those spaces, and just thinking about, you know, not just the power of the daily lives, the little things about, you know, getting chilbanes in your hands and people who don't even remember the word chilbanes and things like that, but also thinking about how powerful it is, I think especially for Southerners, that much of this history is right there, and it, I think, can feel more immediate because of that.
Listen, we have to stop. We obviously keep going. There's many more people with questions for you. But thank you to everyone on the call for creating a rich conversation. And thank you so much, Lois, for spending this time with us. It's been a real treat. I also want to remind everyone about your second novel, Juliet's Nurse, which tells the story of Romeo and Juliet from the vantage point of the nurse. It's definitely on my summer reading list. Thank you very, very much, Lois. We really appreciate being able to spend some time with you tonight.
It has been an absolute pleasure. These have been great questions. And all I would say is, if you enjoyed this book, please let other folks know about it, because that is the way that all of us find our best books, is because somebody says, this is what you must read. And I think particularly if we care about sharing this history, the more that we can all advocate for any way that people can be learning it is really important. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you all.
Oh, thank you. A couple of quick announcements for everyone, and let me pick up on what Lois is saying. If you have a question or you'd like to further comment on the book, send it to me. We can continue the conversation on the blog. I'm going to be announcing our next selection in the next couple of weeks, and I want to ask everyone, keep sending me your suggestions. That's how we found The Secrets of Mary Bowser. So you can email me at kathy.stewart5@gmail.com with books you want us to consider for upcoming selections. I also want to let everyone know that Independent Voting has just launched a national summer survey. It's called 9 Questions for the 44%. Our goal is to speak with 5,000 independent voters across the country by Labor Day. The survey is being coordinated by a dynamic committee chaired by Tiani Coleman from New Hampshire and Randy Miller from Utah. If you haven't taken the survey yet, I hope you'll take a minute tonight, go to Independent Voting's Facebook page and take the survey. And please email me if you'd like to be put in touch with Randy and Tiani to join their committee, so you can conduct the survey in your area. And my email again is kathy.stewart5@gmail.com. Thanks, Lois. Good night, everyone, and happy reading.
So long, everybody. Bye-bye.
Good night.